Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Ray Choate. I'm the University Librarian here at the University of Adelaide, and I have five tasks. Firstly, to welcome all of you to the Barr Smith Library on behalf of the Friends and on behalf of myself, the University Librarian. I wish also to give apologies at this stage. The Premier, the Honorable Mike Rann, has sent his apologies. Professor Penny Bumala, who is the Deputy Vice Chancellor, sends her apologies, and several members of the Friends, Diana Roberts, Stephen Beaumont, Nicole Morecambe, and Cheryl Hoskin, all send their apologies. I'd also like to note that tonight it's a joint meeting with the English Association, and we have about a dozen members of the English Association here, including the President, Tony Lavers. Tony, stand up and let them see who the President of the English Association is. And they have meetings about three or four times a year, and when we have speakers, we sometimes have joint meetings because there's a lot of interest in people who write in the English language. The fourth thing I have to say to you is, if you have a mobile phone, would you please turn it off? Because we are being recorded by Radio Adelaide for later broadcast, and I think our listeners on the air would not appreciate very much having clickety-clicks of phones. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like now to hand everything over to Farley Wright, who's president of the Friends of the University of Adelaide Libraries. Farley.
Not being of such excellent genetic stock as Ray, I've got to lower the microphone a little. good evening, ladies and gentlemen, friends. Lots of new faces tonight. Thank you, Sean, for bringing in a whole fresh new range of readers. Normally, first task I do, this is so in my face, is housekeeping. So first and most important housekeeping is to thank our sponsors, Unibooks. You'll note Lisa up at the door as you walked in. She has copies of Sean's books for sale. They've got 30% off The Crooked Letter at the moment. But there's also, if you want to risk your money, take a try and double your outcome, is if you go down to the bookshop up until, Lisa's at the 31st, competition's running until the 31st. If you purchase another science fiction or fantasy book, you've got the chance of winning first prize, The Crooked Letter, and the whole of The Change Trilogy. Lisa's read all of these. And second, third, fourth prize, other copies of The Crooked Letter. If you purchase a book tonight, then Sean, you're signing, are you?
Absolutely.
Splendid. We've got medical coverage for his RSI. And so be gentle with him. Beyond that, friends of the University of Adelaide Library, if you're not a member, and then we encourage you to join. Brochures at the door. It is free to join. Don't get confused with the standard charge. And then the charge is a discount rate. If you become a member of the Friends, you can get a discount alumni or Friends rate for having borrowing rates from the Barr Smith Library. Being a member also gives you access to a discount rate for independent theatre. And they've just produced Daniel Geronimo. They've got another play coming out later in the year, a little bit later to give you a heads up on now. You also get notification of events, so we let you know, so you don't have to scour the media so hard to find us. And you also get reciprocal rights at the Australian Federation of Friends of Museums and the World Federation of Museums. So for all of those that are absolutely committed geeks and go from city to city visiting one museum to the next, then you know you have benefits by being a friend. Right. The serious work of the evening to introduce our speaker. I feel entirely unauthorized. I've only read 1,000 pages. So I know people out here. Rob, how many thousands of pages have you read, Sunshine? 10, 12,000? It'll be up there. I think you have. Yeah. When they go past 400 pages into 600 pages. So I expect people to come and chastise me strongly afterwards for faults in detail. So I'm most likely speaking to the converted. Nevertheless, he's our local reader. As Jen has pointed out, it is excellent to be able to hear a local reader. That is himself a New York Times best-selling list writer. Not only the quality is affirmed by his readership, but the volume of his production. Looking up your website, he's planned them into the future. He's got one more due this year, two next year, one the year after that. The two space operas are due in the same year. He's nothing if not dedicated. Hence why he's managed to produce 60 short stories and 16 novels at this point. It's great researching you. Every web page you come to or source, the number keeps increasing. So I think, well, I did most of this research this morning. He's probably produced another title since then. His work in space opera, which is a literary genre, Sean and I have covered that this evening, but you should know that he follows in the tradition of the extremely devout Edward Said, who dearly departed from us earlier this year, who's such an amazing theorist, thinker, writer, contributor, who not only was the producer of 250 publications, so you've still got room to cover, but was a concert pianist who played in New York, concert pianist. In 1984, Sean was the winner of the Young Composers Award for a theme with three variations for a string quartet with flute, oboe and trumpet solos. And I do wish that you had stuck with the first title. Was it Cowed They the Rampant Gargoyle Down? Stupendous. So I think he's sort of made up for that in The Crooked Letter. That points towards where he'll take us in the rest of the cataclysm. 13 years of writing. Thank God someone has done it for us. He supports himself as an author, a fiction author, a science fiction and fantasy author. Thank you, Sean, because he's the encouragement to the rest of us. Eva Salas, you'd know Eva Salas? Eva Salas, at the launch of Hayam, challenged all the lawyers in the room who really actually wanted to be novelists to throw away their bar membership and take up the pen. Sean walked away from economics and, bless you, has walked into his convictions and has succeeded. His recognition is 1999 nomination and a 2000 recipient for the South Australian Great Literature Award and a list as long as my long arms of nominations and awards for the Dittmar and Aurealis prizes. Beyond that, not only is he a writer, but he also gives back to the community. A, he chooses to still live here. That's not a light act in a literary world and in a global world. Beyond that, he contributes. He contributes politically. He supports the Australians Against Racism on his website. He put into the community as chair of the South Australian Writers' Centre for 2001, 2002 and 2003. He was a member of the inaugural steering committee for the Big Book Club, which I attended last night. Thank you, Sean, for making that all possible. And he has served as a peer assessor on the Australian Arts Council for Literature. He also appears from time to time as a speaker on futurism. And here's where we get to the significance. Is science fiction and fantasy or speculative fiction merely a literary product? Now, we all know C.P. Snow and the Two Cultures debate. What year did he publish Two Cultures? Back in the 30s? Ray, you're... Sometime in the 30s, right. So our guess is as close. The C.P. Snow argument on the Two Cultures was that there was a chasm between science and the humanities. And science fiction fantasy writers bridged that chasm. And this is important. C.P. Snow identified a great problem for education and for society. How can we move forward when we're not understanding science, when scientists aren't understanding society and culture? And it's our writers such as Sean that helped to bridge that place, that gap. In either the first or the second Festival of Ideas, we had Rodney Brook. Do you know Rodney Brook? Academic researching into robotics at MIT at the time that he was speaking. He stood at the Festival of Ideas and spoke about robotics, so one of the future worlds that we are moving into and that writers like Sean are mapping for us. And on one part of the talk, he spoke about how reading Isaac Asimov as a young man had inspired him into his career, and we hope you inspire us to new careers. On the other end of his talk, he also reassured us that don't take the apocalyptic wasteland writings of science fiction too much to heart, because what they write often doesn't come out. Nevertheless, he actually named his own robotics company iRobot. So the inspiration holds through. And you want to think through the impact that people like Sean can have in us. Arthur C. Clarke came up with the idea of geostationary satellites. H.G. Wells was the first person to write seriously and significantly and with impact about human travel to the moon. And of course, Isaac Asimov's book, The Three Laws of Robotics, still inform us on some of the problems that we may face. And it's writers like Sean Williams that will continue to plot our way through into the near future. Thank you, Sean.
How could I even dream of chastising Fowley after an introduction like that? I'd like to begin with an apology tonight. I'm a little bit jet-lagged. As Paul Theroux once said, travel is only glamorous in retrospect. I'm not quite far enough away from the last trip that I took for it to look glamorous. So if I stumble or stutter, that will be why. As Fowley pointed out, I call myself a speculative fiction writer. For me, that term covers fantasy, science fiction, and horror mainly, but also magic realism, surrealism, utopian fiction, anything, basically, that diverges from the real in a significant way or asks the age-old question, what if? I write, therefore, about things that might exist, don't exist, can't exist, will probably never exist, and often should never exist outside my head. Some people are puzzled by this. Becoming so engrossed by an imaginary space that you forget the world around you is supposed to be for children only. But we all do it, adults and children. We're human because of it. Imagination is a natural and wonderful thing, and much has been spoken of it before by brighter minds than me. All the works of man have their origin in creative fantasy, said Carl Jung. What right have we then to depreciate imagination? Robert Heinlein was equally blunt when he said, to be matter of fact about the world is to blunder into fantasy, and dull fantasy at that, as the real world is strange and wonderful. But what we imagine is intimately entangled with what we know, what we experience. All artists are influenced by the world around them, inevitably, essentially, for that is where we get our ideas from. Information comes in via our senses, rattles around in our minds for a while, then emerges again, reassembled into something new. There's no magical process, no secret trick to it. We are not inventing from scratch. It's just a matter of throwing stuff into the melting pot and letting time and chance do the work. The job of an artist is to separate the good from the bad out of what inevitably emerges and polish it up in order to present it in its best light. Imagination, creativity, fantasy, then, is an illusion, a magic trick. We are master jugglers, hypnotists, armed with the real and willing to use it. To render the fantastic believable, we dress it up in the quotidian, make-believe worlds that look like medieval Europe, space fleets indistinguishable from World War II navies. It's like following a recipe for a curry containing just enough chili, but not too much. You don't want to overpower your audience completely. So although I write about things that aren't real, they come from and are steeped in the real. Otherwise, they simply wouldn't work. It's a complicated dance. One slip and you'll end up tangled in your own legs on the floor. It's further complicated by the fact that the real world already contains books about unreal things, and the temptation is very real to embed your work in this comfortable second-hand reality. And there are plenty of books that rely on this, on such assumed knowledge. It is, in fact, a criticism of science fiction and capital L literature that you can't understand it unless you already know what the jargon or the context is. Perhaps that explains why, at the moment at least, fantasy is the most popular of the speculative triplets. Mass-market fantasy doesn't rely on an assumed knowledge of the genre or science, and it isn't designed to be scary. You might say, were you in a cynical frame of mind, that it's comfortable dream fodder for the masses. Where, then, does the wasteland fit in? Everyday philosopher Robert Fulghum writes that there are places we all come from, deep-rooty, common places that make us who we are. We disdain them or treat them lightly at our peril. We turn backs on them at the risk of self-contempt. The wasteland I want to talk about tonight is not the usual sort of blasted plain found in maps and fantasy novels or the post-apocalyptic wilderness of a lot of old-style science fiction. It's nothing other than our fair city of Adelaide, South Australia, and the life I've had here. I say this knowing full well how it's going to come across. I don't mean to sound disrespectful, although if I do, I'm not the first. Many here will have heard of Salman Rushdie's visit to Adelaide for Writers' Week in 1984. On returning home, he wrote of the grim enigma of Adelaide in The Tattler, saying that Adelaide is an ideal setting for a Stephen King novel or horror film. "You know why all those films and books are always set in sleepy conservative towns?" he asked. "Because sleepy conservative towns are where those things happen. Exorcism, omens, shining, poltergeists. Adelaide is Amityville or Salem, and things here go bump in the night." This is an interesting aspect of Adelaide history, and I'm sure that Mr. Rushdie would only feel supported in this view by the Snowtown murders, the horrific attacks on Adelaide zoo animals, and other sensational crimes as written up by Susan Mitchell in her recent book, All Things Bright and Beautiful, Murder in the City of Light, which is still currently banned here, although I'm pleased to have a copy. I am, however, not referring to this aspect of Adelaide's history, although of course I use it as often as I can in stories like The Hunting Ground, which came out in a collection called Southern Blood last year. I'm not referring either to the oft-quoted factoid that Adelaide is the driest city in the driest state on the driest continent on Earth, even though you wouldn't think it after the winter we've just had. I'm not referring to the Adelaide many people experienced as a teenager, one in which nothing seemed new or interesting, where everyone already knew everyone else, where all the really cool stuff was happening a really long way away. I sometimes felt like I was the only person of my generation who didn't want to move to Sydney or Melbourne the very second I finished school. I like it here. I really do and always have. It's my home. Yes, I occasionally destroy it in my stories, but we always hurt the ones we love. And my story, Ghost of the Fall, depicts Adelaide as a flooded ruin. In it, an earthquake sets swinging the clapper of Great Fred, St. Peter's largest bell, and its tolling foretells the end of the line for the city's shrinking band of survivors. White Christmas is a witness to an alien invasion that looks like snow, stands on the summit of Mount Lofty and watches in horror as the State Bank building, whatever it's called now, melts away like ice cream under the hot sun. But I'm not always so malicious. A story called Reluctant Misty and the House on Burden Street sees Adelaide more realistically, through the eyes of a woman obsessed with not a haunted house, but a haunting house in North Adelaide. So you have the lush green streets, you have the shadowy, echoing recesses of this beautiful library here, where she digs through old records for information. You have the century-old newspaper stories she finds about the city when it was young. This is the Adelaide we live in, and the one I prefer to visit when I can. As Robert Fulghum goes on to say, there is a sense in which we need to go home again and can go home again, not to recover home, no, but to sanctify memory. We write our own histories. Our heads simply aren't big enough to contain every memory we've ever laid down, so we keep the ones that are relevant and bury or just forget the rest. We are inevitably shaped by the past, but we in turn shape the past we carry around with us. The way people tell the story of their lives is important as the lives themselves. Would we rather live in David Copperfield or Annie or The Sword in the Stone? It's to a large degree up to us. My story begins in Whyalla of the 1960s, a very different town of the Whyalla today. My father was a school teacher in a busy community. A country boy from Victoria, he had met my mother in the next town south, Cowell, a tiny place now known for oysters and the massive black jade deposit lying dormant beneath it. After a short stint in Werribee Forest, they'd come to Whyalla to start a family. The truth is, I don't remember a thing about Whyalla from back then. We didn't stay very long. Shortly after my sister was born, we moved to Ararat and Stahl and elsewhere, following my father around from job to job. Later, I would get to know Whyalla as a place to pass through on the way to see my grandparents in Cowell, or as a venue for family engagements and weddings. It was a way station that was in the process of becoming somewhere else itself, shrinking and desiccating, a place of strange chimney stacks and dusty roads. I don't claim to know it well and have never considered it home. But if I had a home back then, given all the travelling my family was doing, it was that little town south of Whyalla that I've mentioned a couple of times already. Cowell. My mother's uncle had taken over the family farm when I was a child, so visits to that end of the world were divided between my grandparents' house in sleepy old Cowell and the farm just out of town. Now, Eyre Peninsula, I presume everybody here has been to Eyre Peninsula, so I'm going to describe it anyway. It's a dry, flat place. The farm was named after and boasted a geological feature called Mount Garrity makes it sound more dramatic than it was. Mount Garrity is a pimple, really, compared to the sort of mountains they have elsewhere overseas. It's quite climbable, even by small children, and I don't think anyone's ever fallen to their deaths from any of its faces. But it has its own ancient ground-down charm. It's a survivor, a relic of times long past. Climbing it, you can just make out the shadow of ancient mountain ranges that might have stood there before the sea came in and ground them down. You can practically smell the time when you plant your feet on its summit and breathe in deep. The farm was a wonderful place to be as a kid. The sound of wind hissing through trees when I'd go outside after midnight to take a leak. The endless promise of rain that never came. Dry creek beds lurking like giant orange snakes in the stubble of wheat and barley. I have a very clear memory of one of my uncles telling me to watch out for kangaroos while climbing Mount Garrity. "They can grab you round the throat," he told me, "and gut you with one kick of their hind legs." I was mortified. Until that moment, kangaroos had meant skippy and stuffed toys. From then on, they were vicious killers. I've never wanted to know just how much of this was just a joke on a city boy, just in case it's even partly true. Don't tell me. Cal and that farm were where I chose to go on school holidays. If I had a choice, I would rather stay with my grandparents than fight with my sister over who's taking up more of the back seat on a driving holiday of New Zealand or whatever else was on offer. There was plenty to see and do in Cal, if you look for it. For hours, I would watch my grandfather cut and polish jade in his workshop, burning the sound of diamond-bladed saws and the smell of polish into my brain. The sleepy Main Street shops were full of all sorts of nooks and crannies that contained things that hadn't sold for decades. One of them even had one of those old pneumatic tube systems. Does anybody here remember them that used to ferry change backwards and forwards just over your head with the most incredible noise? I still remember it. And not far south of Cowell is a stretch of sandhills that my grandfather used to take me to, and to which I've returned in my fiction as frequently as I have Adelaide. It was in Cowell that I first tried my hand at writing. It was in Cal that I first fell in love with Gustav Holst's The Planet Suite. It was in Cal that I saw my first shooting star on the night of my 10th birthday, and where I learned to drive. I've never lived in Cal, but it is still the centre of my universe. As long as I know it's there, things are the way they ought to be. After a couple of years in Mount Gambier and a 4-year stint in Adelaide, during which my mother also trained to be a teacher, subjecting me and my sister to all sorts of tests and experiments, she claimed it was to make sure that Piaget's theories were still working, but I'm not sure. After all that, we ended up in Darwin, where Dad acted as a liaison between the education department and various Aboriginal communities. I don't think I truly appreciated until later what an amazing opportunity this was for anyone, let alone a preteen boy in love with the notion of the alien and the other embedded in science fiction. I have vivid memories of coming home from school to find a dozen tribal elders sitting in our living room passing around a jar of honey ants preserved in their own sticky syrup, and they were delicious. I remember being backstage at the Festival Theatre where, as part of a cultural exchange program, the menu consisted of pie floaters and witchetty grubs. I remember my family going on camp into the outback with 60 full-blood kids and learning about traditional dances, how to use a woomera, and where to find crocodile eggs. I grew up taking these things for granted, and I'm left with the conviction that every child in this country should do the same. To our great shame, we ignore our heritages as rich as the ones we brought with us from overseas, and I hope that one day this divide will be crossed and the best of every culture will be allowed to flourish and coexist here. Obviously, we were having pretty amazing times in Darwin. I hated the weather, loathed it, but I think apart from that, and one other very important reason, we could have stayed up there forever. That other reason was my father, who I had learned in 1979 always wanted to be a priest. Now, chucking in what seemed a perfectly good job and a very high-paying job in order to enter a profession that is poorly paid and highly stressed probably seemed insane to everyone around him, his family and his friends. But to his credit, he followed his dream. So off we went, back to Adelaide, into a series of small, dingy houses that changed every couple of years depending on where Dad was posted. Now, I entered high school in 1980, at about the same time my father started his divinity diploma. And the idea that one studied religion outside of Sunday school must surely have been new to me then, although it seems natural now. These things bear close examination, whichever side of the ideological fence you're on. My father devoted himself to that study with the same sort of manic, contagious energy that drove every other aspect of his life. I retain vivid memories of him bursting out of his office, as anyone studying for exams will do, overflowing with knowledge that might evaporate if he didn't constantly bring it out for inspection. Mixed up in my head because of this, with my own algebra and English assignments, are pop quizzes about different sorts of poetry in the Old Testament and definitions of faded myth. I would pore over different editions of the Bible I found in his office, fascinated by the way something I had taken completely for granted previously could come in so many different forms. It was like picking away at the mortar in a wall and discovering that some bricks were made of cheese while others were completely hollow. It was disorienting and wonderful at the same time. The sad fact is that by exposing me to an education in religion, my father probably sowed the seeds of my own irreligious leanings today. Sometime early in 1985, as I waited for the curtain to go up on my first ever appearance as an actor on stage, I came to the abrupt realization that I was an atheist. Life just seemed so much simpler that way, with the Bible and other texts reduced to the level of good stories rather than internally inconsistent dogma. Thus I have remained ever since, although my taste for such stories remains. And so too have I remained in Adelaide. I've lived at all points of the compass, from Kernelight Gardens to Burnside, from Elizabeth Downs to Torrensville. I currently live at the centre of the compass in that strange no man's land south of Carrington Street that is neither business nor residential, but which city planners seem hell-bent on forcing to be both. While thinking about this talk, I was surprised by the number of metaphorical and literal wastelands I found in my life. It is here in Adelaide, in a sort of urban wasteland, that I sit and contemplate the peculiar directions my life has taken. Or so it seems sometimes to the people on the outside looking in. I live in Adelaide and I write books. I was frequently asked when I first started out whether I intended to move to Sydney or Melbourne in order to further my career. That was where writers went to make their fortune, apparently. I had no such intentions. I liked living in Adelaide and a story was a story. Where did it matter where it was written? What did it matter where it was written? I was equal parts naive and prescient. Not long after I started writing, the internet boomed, and it was suddenly possible to conduct business in the publishing world with anyone, anywhere, at any time. When it came to making deals, editing, communicating with readers, it genuinely didn't matter that I lived a long way from the publishing mecca of New York or its satellites, London and Sydney. It even made sense to live somewhere like Adelaide, which had a very low cost of living and a supportive arts funding body. With the money I saved on rent and groceries, and very good wine, I could easily afford several trips east to press the flesh whenever it was necessary. And it is necessary. We are by nature social creatures. No one wants to do business with a faceless stranger forever. And the importance of community should not ever be underestimated by anyone. One of the best ways for writers to learn is from their peers. The principle of paying forward, passing on what you've learned to the next person in line, rather than trying to pay back the person you got it from, which is never entirely possible. This is a principle that's firmly enshrined in the speculative fiction world. Without such help in my early days, I wouldn't be where I am now. And I make a point now of getting out of the office as often as I can to pay forward and to remind everyone I work with that I am in fact a real person and not a machine for churning out books. Adelaide, in terms of the science fiction writing community, was something of a wasteland when I first started out, or so it seemed to me. I think I came in at a bit of a dry patch. Most of the action seemed to be taking place in Melbourne and Perth. The few contacts I did make, such as my first publisher, Peter McNamara, and my collaborator, Shane Dix, were to be treasured. That's one metaphorical wasteland. Then there's the wasteland of economics, and I apologise to anybody, and I know there's at least one in the audience who studied economics. Somehow, shortly after finishing high school, I came to the conclusion that I should get a good job first and then worry about writing second. So I enrolled in an economics degree here at Adelaide University and set off on a career that would, I hoped, see me earn enough money to retire young. This apparently foolproof plan was stymied, thank you, almost immediately when it became very obvious even to me that I didn't like economics very much. And wouldn't even see out the end of the degree, let alone retirement. So midway through the long dark tunnel of third year, during which I pursued the bold strategy of not going to lectures or tutorials at all, without withdrawing from the course, I had to confront the most basic issue we all have to deal with. What do we want to do with the rest of our lives? Luckily for me, or eventually for me, the answer was obvious. I wanted to write. I'd been scribbling away most of my life, ever since those early days in Cal when I was 10 years old. So doing more of it wasn't unappealing. It just took a bit of convincing to believe that I could actually make a living from it. I knew by then that writers earn a pittance and work bloody hard for it, even harder than Anglican priests. Did I really want to embark on a career that might see me get nowhere? I decided, perhaps foolishly, that I did. I would rather be poor and fulfilled than rich and hollow. If I could, you know, if it would take hard work, that was fine. You know, I can work hard at something that I love. It's working at something that I hate that's hard. I was naturally worried about how my parents would react, but I shouldn't have been, because Dad had obviously been through that very wasteland himself, and he had come out the other side a happier man for it. It's a matter of odd timing that at the same time I was going through this premature midlife crisis, my father was going through a very real health crisis, one that would, 7 years later, just after my first novel was published, finally claim his life. Now, I'm not one who believes in meaningful coincidences, but there's no denying that this smacks of plotting. It would be tempting and reassuring to believe that someone out there is drawing a story arc across my life, giving it meaning and structure instead of the usual chaotic ramble. That I still can't believe in such a thing, that I still can't believe in God, has perhaps more to do with my stubbornness than any pretense of rationality. Wastelands, like deserts and polar regions, aren't dead places. They are vital and vigorous in their own ways. Sometimes, like my father did, we need to cross the wasteland in order to get where we want to be. Sometimes we get halfway across and realize that it's right there, in the wasteland that we belong. Instead of blots on the world, mistakes that need to be rubbed out or ignored, wastelands are as much a part of the world as we are. Nature has many faces, none more correct than any other. The Star Wars model of world building, in which planets can be characterized by a single adjective such as forest or ice or desert, is simplistic and perhaps a little wishful. I bet if only the real world was that simple. The truth is, we need wastelands. They inspire us, or provoke us, or invoke in us aspects of our characters that might never be given a chance to flourish otherwise. They are mirrors we hold up to ourselves, like science fiction is purported to be. I wander through my personal wilderness where faith is as scarce as water, pursued by the ghost of a religion that doesn't make any sense, and I find inspiration all around me. The stories told down thousands of years about how the world was made and how humanity was given a place in it, stories from 100 cultures, living and dead, have currency in this wasteland. People didn't make up these tales for fun. Such narratives gave their lives meaning. They explained the world. They helped the people, like my father, who told them, to cope with the unknowable. What, I asked myself, if anything, could lie behind these stories? If they are smoke signals from more numinous lands, what fire created them? My latest novel, The Crooked Letter, is an attempt to answer that question, and is arguably my most autobiographical novel in that sense. It's a map I've made of that personal wilderness. It begins with two ideas, and the first is that if the soul exists, how does it fit into the world we see around us? Nature, as we understand it, is all about eating and being eaten. What kind of creature could possibly eat the soul? The second question concerns life after death. If we start with two identical twins, connected, as some people believe, by a kind of psychic force, what happens if one of them dies and goes to hell? How will his experiences impact, through that psychic link, on the surviving twin here in this world? That's where The Crooked Letter starts, and it ends with an attempt to build a religion that makes sense to me. You know, if I had to believe a religion, this would be one that I could probably accept. It's one that, given the assumptions that souls and some sort of life after death are real, might underpin the world we live in. To build that idea, I've lifted ideas from everywhere. The notion some cultures, including Aboriginal cultures, have of that humans possess two souls, not just one, plus the idea of reincarnation. Throw in the faculties of Plato, the id, ego, superego, Ketha, Chokma, Bina, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. Throw in the Gilgalim of the Kabbalah, and it sort of begins to take shape in the sort of vast melting pot at the back of my head, and you end up with lives sort of curling back on themselves like snakes eating their own tails, like Ouroboros. And I've sometimes thought that, you know, if this writing lark fell through, I could instead try forming a cult around this idea. And I wouldn't be the first speculative fiction writer to try that. But this isn't the wilderness for me. I've got nothing on the people who take this sort of stuff seriously, the kind of people who spend billions of dollars campaigning against evolution and stem cell research or throw firebombs at abortionists. I find it an interesting place to visit, but I wouldn't want to live there. I live in Adelaide. We kept coming back to this. I live in Adelaide, and living in Adelaide is about more than comfortable rent and high-quality restaurants and good wine. It's more than the Essay Writers Festival and WOMAD. It's more than the dry climate and the reputation for weird murders. And it's more than all the churches and all the pubs and all the pubs that used to be churches and all that sort of stuff. We have thinkers in residence here, an idea I like, even if it's a flawed one. Why, for instance, don't we listen to the thinkers who already live here? Why import someone to reinvent the wheel or ignore them if they do happen to point out something profound? When describing recent thinker Charles Landry's opinion of Adelaide in August's Adelaide Review, Peter Ward wrote, "One of the problems Landry has always had about Adelaide is that it's too long, and when not too long, too flat and wide, and altogether lacking the close knobbly bumps and kinks of old world cities." And there, I think, lies one of Adelaide's key charms. It's not a faux New York like Sydney, or an echo of London like Melbourne. It's nothing like the old world cities our forebears left behind. I don't think, to be honest, it's even a city at all. I think it's at heart a small town. And the more it tries to convince people otherwise, the more foolish it begins to look, like a younger daughter trying too hard to ape the glamour of her older sisters, completely failing in the process to see that the awareness of one's limitations is the essence of beauty. Adelaide is like nowhere else in this country, and trying to be something it's not will only diminish the charm that it already has. We should own our differences, not bury them or our heads in the wasteland over the fence. We do so at our own peril. Not that something is going to come crawling out of that desert, some metaphorical giant lizard grown big and mad on radioactive waste, intent on stomping us all to Armageddon. Nothing so dramatic. Desert environments are traditionally defined in terms of an absence of water, as arguably they should be, since everyone knows we need to be careful with such scarce resources, otherwise we might run out. But that focus on absence ignores the presence of the desert itself and the opportunities we might miss if we ignore it. Let me tell you something about the sort of landscape I write about. Fantasy is all about landscape. One of the things it does best is create secondary worlds in which new stories can take place, stories that can't exist today. These secondary worlds can be based on historical worlds. Adelaide's own Leon Hearn writes her stories in a medieval Japan. David Gemmell sets his novels in mythical worlds like Atlantis. Some writers like Marion Zimmern Bradley do it in a blend of both, as in her novel Mists of Avalon. Or they can be completely made up, as Tolkien did with Middle-earth. Anyone who has read Tolkien or seen the movies will recognise the dense forests, the snow-capped mountains and tumbling rivers that overflow from the fantasy genre's larder. Did Tolkien kickstart this medievalist trend, or was it always there, just waiting to be popularised? You might argue that the landscape of the Lord of the Rings is part of the cultural baggage of the British Empire, which the colonies look fondly back to as we face an uncertain future. Perhaps we find this stylized Europe comforting. Certainly we find it familiar. I personally have never seen snow, but I've read descriptions of it many times throughout my life. Fantasy novels hark back to a natural era that probably never existed as we imagine it, but which perpetuates itself with its own kind of momentum. It's not just the European landscape that we find familiar, but European myth too. Elves, dwarves and giants are tropes that every Western child learns about as they learn to read. Serious treatments in more mature writings prolong and expand the experience of these myths. Readers of these works go on to become writers, and so the cycle begins again. The mode is self-perpetuating. Even I, who has never been to Europe, found myself succumbing to the temptation. When I first tried my hand at writing in the fantasy genre, the natural thing to do was to follow the established form. And naturally, it didn't work. Since I knew nothing about these landscapes except secondhand, I could never write honestly or effectively about them. I had to write about somewhere else instead. Now, this landscape, This landscape is one that has changed dramatically since its inception, since its creation. It's wandered many thousands of kilometres across the face of the world at the whim of forces that people living on it may never truly understand. Its nature has changed many times. Rugged mountains once stretched across it, bearing mighty sheets of ice on their backs. Later, jungles sprawled from side to side, home to human-sized, warm-bodied lizards with eyes adapted for night vision. The remains of these long-dead creatures have opalized, creating powerful reminders of the fragility of existence in such a mutable world. In other ages, active volcanoes erupted along the land's coastlines as seas advanced and retreated in cycles too long for humans to comprehend. Temperatures rose and fell as dramatically as the coastlines, and with each cycle of flooding and drying, the land baked a little more, gradually withering as though cursed by a vengeful god. Where salt lakes and deserts now exist, once stretched vast expanses of arable land. Warm, wet forests have become layers of mummified leaves in ancient mud. Ripples on desert rocks show that sediments were once laid at the bottom of a creek that dried up long ago. Vast stretches of open grassland spread in the wake of the forests, inhabited and grazed by large running avian species that have also become extinct. Forced between extremes of ice and fire, life evolved in unique directions. Monsters once walked this land. Monsters that are remembered in legend by the people who settled there and hunted them to extinction. Clever, two-legged marsupials still travel as fast as horses through the patchy scrub that remains. Humans have given landscape that no longer exists exotic names like the Iromanga Sea, the Moravian Gulf, Lake Bungania. These words carry the hint of legend and promise a million stories, as though by naming them we can ever hope to understand them, contain them, and own them. This is the land of the Stone Mage and the Sea, the first of my books of the change. I've set four novels in this world now, and there are two more to come. Europe is a long way from this world. There isn't a forest in sight, not a single snowflake, and no rivers. Instead, there's the sea, the sun and the sand, there's space and dryness, and the terrible struggle to survive. But I didn't make up this wasteland. Everything I've just told you about exists and surrounds us now, right where we're sitting. South Australia is an amazing place. All I had to do was dress it up a bit. I've tried to capture the essence of this land, the land I've grown up in and love, and convey it to the reader anew. I haven't appropriated Aboriginal myths any more than I've used the usual European legends. I've tried to make it my own, to create a secondary world to which I instinctively respond. That readers respond to it too tells me that I'm onto something, not something new necessarily, because storytellers in this country have always struggled to deal with the vast reality that we have taken for our home. But something honest and real, common to us all. Now, just because I found inspiration in this world, in this place, just because I don't get the Eurocentric thing, that doesn't mean that others on a different path are misguided. There is room in the world for many, many different stories. We are limited only by our imaginations and our readers' willingness to run with us. If people want yarns in which Europe is the other, give it to them, I say, because fulfilling that desire is part of what fantasy is all about. Fantasy that doesn't give us what we yearn for or expect risks failing on a fundamental level. But it still surprises me. Most fantasy novels by local writers are written in the European mode. Are such writers missing out on an opportunity to mine the land we know and love for inspiration? Is Adelaide in South Australia the wasted land of the speculative fiction field rather than a wasteland per se? Or are we only beginning to find our way through the cultural minefield that is appropriation and land ownership? Perhaps we're still too young as a nation to feel at home with the land we occupy, like the early colonial painters who got the colour of leaves and sky completely wrong. Perhaps in a couple more generations we'll be mature enough or integrated enough to feel comfortable with looking outside the cities and farms for the deep heart of our environment and to hear what it has to tell us. Now here's a statistic just to sort of round things off. My novels are published by HarperCollins Australia under its Voyager imprint. There are currently more authors signed to that imprint living in Adelaide than there are anywhere else in Australia. Melbourne has two, Sydney has two, Perth has two, Alice Springs has one, New Zealand has one. Adelaide has six. It's obviously we're doing something right. My feelings on what that something might be are on record now, having been quoted in a recent Adelaide Matters. Part of it has to do with Adelaide's isolation. I know Perth is technically more isolated, But Adelaide is the city that traditionally misses out. Bands still skip Adelaide on national tours. We still don't have an IKEA, although I think that's changing. Fingers crossed. Adelaide is the other, the outsider, and everyone who lives here, I think, feels it. And for all its marvellous antiquity, it's pretty flat and dull, topologically speaking. Mount Lofty isn't all that lofty, and the Torrens isn't so much a river as a creek. So we have to kind of fill in the blanks in the landscape with something else. For some people, it's festivals and fringes and Grand Prix. For others, it's fantasy. We imagine distant lands and magical worlds that offer us what we don't have right here. Some of those lands are inevitably wastelands. As I said at the beginning of this talk, what we see around us is it feeds into our creative lives. The blasted lands of fantasy, the post-apocalyptic ruins of science fiction, the sleepy small towns Stephen King employs to great effect in his novels. They may not have literal existence in this world, but they are drawn closely from reality, just as the experiences of our characters are based on from those we ourselves have had, especially when concerning issues of vocation, of community, of destiny, of God. Storytellers plumb the depths and heights within and around them for signs of meaning and reveal glimpses of something that might, however briefly, pass as the truth. And I see nothing at all wrong with that. As the late, great Iris Murdoch once said, we live in a fantasy world, a world of illusion. The great task in life is to find reality. Thank you. Any questions?
Do you feel you could have had such inspiration than imagination had you been elsewhere?
Sure. I just think the books would have been very different. I think I would have written different things. If I'd lived in England, I think there was a greater chance that my fantasy novels would have been written in the Tolkien-esque mode, and I would have been quite as happy with that. Certainly if I'd seen snow, I would use snow in my stories. I think I'm dying to see snow so I can. There is a risk. I couldn't put numbers on it. There's a risk that either the novel won't connect with the fantasy market and will disappear. There's a risk that there's a chance that the novel will connect with something that hasn't been fulfilled up to that point and may suddenly explode across the market and be a bestseller. Some recent authors, China Miéville's one, who's certainly not writing in the Tolkien-esque mode, who is an international megastar now because he's breaking that mould. Australian author KJ Bishop is another one who's definitely not writing in the Tolkien-esque mode but is winning awards all over the world because she's doing different things. Sometimes you do slip through the cracks, and there is a risk. And it depends on the editor, I guess, and the publisher. I think every publisher wants to publish a certain amount of the same sort of stuff, not meaning that in a derogatory way because, I mean, I'm guilty of wanting to read similar sorts of material myself. They want to publish maybe 80% of that and 20% they can experiment with. Maybe. Hard to put figures on it.
But so is that personally gratifying when your editor says, yeah, this is really good, this is very different?
Sure. And what's most personally gratifying is when readers come up to me and say, I know exactly the place you're talking about on Eyre Peninsula. I've been there. I lived there. One woman actually lived there, which I thought was incredible. And she recognised the place. And that for me is amazing, when they're getting the feel of the landscape from my book. That's very flattering.
As one who grew up with the legend, I'll call it that now, of the cultural cringe, mm-hmm. It's really great to hear of something inspired by Cowell, Wyala, Eyre Peninsula, and all that magical desert-like place.
Mm. Well, I think so too. Who, Kim, you can help me, sorry. Who wrote, Patricia Wrightson, sorry to drag you. Patricia Wrightson wrote fantasy and horror novels set in the Central Australian region using Aboriginal myths, and I loved those books when I was a kid because I could kind of relate to the world she was painting. The Tolkien-esque fantasies, they could have been on an alien planet for all I was concerned, and as I've got older, I have had a feel that You know, I don't want to theorize too deeply because I don't think I'm quite informed enough too, but I do get a feeling that it is a cultural cringe thing, that if you want to use magic and if you want to get something special in the world, you kind of have to go back to the old world. You have to go back to Europe. You have to go back to England. That special things only happen there. They don't happen here because this land is dead and terra nullius, and there's nothing here. And I disagree very strongly with that. I think there are wonderful things here. And the idea that the desert is dead and empty, I think is really wrong. I think you've only got to travel up to the northern end of the Flinders Ranges and sit on a hill for half an hour and appreciate just how rich the landscape is. And I mean, granted, there may not be a forest you can get lost in, and there may not be herds of bison rumbling by, and there may not be ruined cities just a mile down the track, but the land itself and the ecosystem that's there is superb and wondrous and profound and affecting, I think. Thank you.
Do you have a favourite science fiction author and a favourite fantasy author? And if you do, which... what is it about their books that you like? How much does that influence you?
Well, at the moment, my favourite fantasy writer... Because every year it changes. My favourite fantasy writer at the moment is a guy called Tim Powers, because I like the way he constructs fantasy novels and fantasy systems of magic, and he uses humor in his fantasy, and he's not so serious. And but as to who influenced me, is that writers like Stephen Donaldson when I was a teenager really influenced me, because he was writing stuff definitely set in the Tolkienist mode, but where the characters ran around raping each other and doing terrible, terrible things to each other. I just can't imagine that happening in Tolkien's world. Inconceivable. So his use of characters in that kind of world I found absolutely fascinating. And authors like Greg Bear, Larry Niven, to a certain extent these days, Ian Banks in particular at the moment, having just gone back to his work, these writers all kind of feed into the melting pot and slosh around, and you never quite know what's going to come out. It's a very hard question to answer because I always forget 90% of the names. James Morrow was a fantasy writer I particularly like. Sean Stewart as well. Yeah. WRIGHTSON, and she's a marvelous forgotten Australian writer, and one of the great Australian fantasists who was writing in the 70s, and books like Rocks of Honey profoundly affected me when I was younger, and they're not even in print now, which I think is very, very dismaying, and I'm not sure exactly why. There could be a number of reasons, but they were superbly powerful books about our landscape. They may be in the libraries, yeah, about the place. I hope they're in this library here.
You've told us about travelling to other publishing houses in the world. Do you find that you get inspired by these landscapes?
The first time I went to LA 11 years ago, I came back and wrote 40,000 words of fiction in 1 week, inspired by the sight of an LA freeway. So absolutely. I came back from New York last year, inspired to write a thriller set in New York. I haven't done anything with London yet. I only saw London for the first time. London last year was my first glimpse of Europe ever. And there was no snow. I was quite disappointed. And it was much smaller and dirtier than I was imagining. So that's kind of floating around there somewhere. I'm sure it'll pop out eventually. But yes, absolutely, definitely, landscapes. I mean, I think there's a risk in being a writer firmly established in one place, that eventually you kind of tap that vein and throwing as much information as landscape and people in as possible into your head. I don't know. I think people are still puzzled by it to a certain extent. But given the fact that we now do have 6 very well-known fantasy writers living right here in South Australia has eased some of that cringe. I think we're proving that you can live here and make a living and do very well and publish around the world without having to leave Adelaide or to be ashamed of living in Adelaide. I think that leading by example, I think, is a good thing. Maybe in 10 years' time, everyone will live here. And people will be wondering why all the writers in Sydney aren't moving here. In fact, I actively encourage friends in Sydney who are writers and struggling on... I mean, the average wage for a writer in Australia is $5,000, which means that anybody who's writing has to have a second job, unless they're up the top end of the bell curve. And I'd look at my writer friends in Sydney and say, why are you living in Sydney? Why aren't you living here? You know, the cost of living is the lowest in the country, just about, and we have fantastic wine. So if you're not selling, you can get drunk, you know, on your puny wage. I mean, why would you live in Sydney where you have to live in a box? So, yeah. There's a story I like to tell where I wrote about three quarters of my first novel, Metal Fatigue, and I decided to send three chapters to Pam McMillan here in Australia, who had their own fantasy line back in the 90s, early 90s, and they indicated that they were looking for science fiction. So I thought I'd send a synopsis and the first three chapters off to the commissioning editor. So I did, and it's very, very nerve-wracking doing it. That's the biggest hurdle you have to get over is sending your work out, expecting for it to be rejected. That's like, you know, bending over to be kicked. It's not much fun. So I sent the manuscript out, and the very next day, I swear it was the very next day, I was sitting in the car in a queue for petrol, and the commissioning editor of Pam McMillan was on the radio on Triple J being interviewed about their fantasy line. And the interviewer said, "So what sort of books are you looking for?" And she said, "Well, I can tell you exactly what we're not looking for." And the book that I'd sent her was my first novel, Metal Fatigue, which is set in a post-apocalyptic landscape where there's one city sort of struggling to survive while the rest of the world has devolved into chaos and disorder. And she said, what we're not looking for is post-apocalyptic landscapes, one city surviving again. So I put my head on my steering wheel and thought, damn. And sure enough, 6 months later, it came back rejected. And so that was a bit dispiriting. But you know, I had a bit of a dream run. I had an editor, my friend Peter McNamara, who sadly passed away this year, actually approached me and my co-writer Shane Dix to write a novel, and that never happens. I don't know other writers that's ever happened to. Oh, actually, I know one other writer that's happened to. And you just don't say no to that sort of deal. And we would never have said no to Peter anyway. So so that was how we got our first deal. And the second deal flowed from there and from there. But getting over that first hurdle of sending out your work, I think, is the hardest thing. You've got to keep putting it out and keep putting it out and keep putting it out and being confident in your own work. And that way you'll eventually get there.
No, I didn't see one. That was the last question. Kim, were you going to ask a question then? I thought that would be interesting if you were about to
It's my partner asking me a question. Yes.
Jen, if you want to make your way up, while Jen's coming up, your comment about landscape and the local, while I was sitting there and reading and I'm thinking, the Adelaide landscape is cool, so I'm thinking, just humour me for a moment. In the Crooked Letter, when the three spires surrounding Yod come down and touch upon the mountain on the top of the hill, and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, Mount Lofty that you referred to, and the three television towers, I don't know if you'd like to...
That's completely intentional.
Completely intentional.
It is now. Thank you, Felly.
On behalf of the Friends of the Adelaide Library and also the University of English University English Association, I'd like to thank you for coming down and sort of sharing your thoughts and experiences with us. On the positive side, I'd like to reassure you that Patricia Wrightson is still being taught in children's literature classes.
That's very good.
So there's a whole batch of teachers going through who are being taught their Patricia Wrightson, which hopefully they're passing on to their students. And yes, on behalf of all of us, I'd like to say thank you and present this token of our appreciation.
And it's a fair exchange. We've given him a book voucher and I get his watch. thanks, Sean. the usual farewells. The next author event is Jack Turner on Thursday, the 18th of November. That's yet to be confirmed on the exact date. Jack Turner is another one of our local products, another Australian writer, one of the true dinkums. He's another alumnus of the University of Adelaide. He, in fact, is a recipient of a Rhodes Scholarship. He doesn't match in Ditmars and Aurealis. But he does have a Rhodes to Oxford, and he's now living in New York, so he's not quite as faithful. nevertheless, he does come home, and his first book, Spice, has been a success as another first novel effort from a local lad. I haven't had a chance to read it yet. I'm still finishing off another novel. So we rely on the other reviewers. Quote, what Turner does in Spice is to conduct a sort of retrospective focus group with ancient medieval consumers of spice. By combing through literature, historical records, diaries, and archaeological evidence, he shows how people viewed spices, costly, exotic, sexy, dangerous, and what they were willing to risk to get them, a money, life, war, hell. It seems nothing's changed. Spice, I understand. We've already got copies at Unibooks, have we, Lisa? We have, right. And then the thank yous for the evening, Ray Choate, the University Librarian, his warm support and encouragement and involvement. Paul Wilkins, University Deputy Librarian, without which none of this would be possible. Thank you, Paul. Staff members from the library, Rabina Weir, Alison Wood, Helen Attar, and Matt Lumsden, and Damien, who set the room up for us every week. That's every event. That's fantastic. Patricia Hawke from the office, who fills all your RSVPs, so you don't get to see her tonight, but you've all spoken to her. And, of course, we'd like to thank Unibooks that makes this all possible through their sponsorship. So thank you, Sean. Thank you, everybody, for coming out this evening. Thank you.